Okay, ice cream, meditation, and disappearing. People like ice cream, I like ice cream, but as a monk, I never had any ice cream today, but very often you have ice cream and you put it in your bowl. And so even a couple of months ago, I had a strawberry ice cream and it fell on top of my spaghetti. So as a monk, you have spaghetti with strawberry ice cream on top. And all the ice cream had disappeared in the cracks of the spaghetti. And all you had was a strawberry taste. Is that delicious? Do you think that's nice?
No.
Okay, how do you know? How many of you have had strawberry cream or spaghetti? Now you find out the source of craving and delusion. We always assume that such things, they cannot be delicious. But you don't know until you've tried. It is a problem with human beings. We carry on so many assumptions without having experienced things. So in meditation we learn how to experience these profound truths and these weird experiences, which we may think may be boring, we may think may be useless, but as you get deeper into things in meditation, you find, number one, it's certainly not boring, and it's very empowering and very full of insight as well. For example, if you do have the weird experience, like I have, of strawberry ice cream or spaghetti, only then do you know that you are like, it's disgusting. It's not a nice thing to me at all. But you can't say that because you never experienced it. But the same thing which happens with this great tradition of Buddhist meditation, and meditation, the Buddha invented it, is a very strong scholastic, scriptural idea that the Buddha started all of this. And first of all, to mention that when the Buddha was teaching meditation, or would learn meditation, the first thing which in the Buddha's story he did was to be a tough guy, hardly ever eating, and just sleeping out, enduring such hardships, and he found he was getting absolutely nowhere. And it's important to know this point, because this gives you a foundation in understanding how meditation works. And getting nowhere and frustrated, he decided to recall a time when he was a young boy sitting under what was called the rose apple tree, where he was just basically doing nothing, watching his father doing a boring ceremony. And at that time he developed this very deep meditation which gave him lots of bliss and lots of power. And he recalled, maybe that is the power, that is the path, sorry, to insight, these deep meditations. Now, first of all, he could only get that meditation when he was sitting comfortably under a tree as a young boy, fully fed, relaxed. And he did that spontaneously. He wasn't striving to get into this deep state of meditation. It just happened. It's a very important point that when you strive for these things, they never happen. And number two, he was very tired, very weak, with not eating so well, and he realized you can't get into a deep meditation if your body is weak, emaciated, tired, uncomfortable. Which is one of the reasons why when we meditate, please sit on the chairs, please sit on the cushions, please have a nice, comfortable place to meditate in. And sometimes if you have any difficulty in meditating, don't just think it's because I don't know how to do it, or that perhaps that I'm not skilled enough. Look for some of the obvious solutions, such as, are you sitting comfortably? Is it a calm, cool place? Before this talk and meditation, we saw a little video reminding me of my time in Thailand when I was a young monk. when he used to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and start meditating at 3:15, I'd always fall asleep. But a fascinating thing happened when, like many monks, I went to Bangkok to renew my visa, which you had to do annually. And I stayed at that time in that other temple you saw, Wat Pho Won. And they had just built a new residential building for visiting monks. And as part of that building, they had one room which was air-conditioned. And because we were up very early, and because that they weren't using it for anything else at that time of the morning, we got permission to get the key and do our morning meditation in that air-conditioned room. And that was the first time in 5 or 6 years you'd seen air conditioning. And straight away, you know, myself and the other monks who were with me at the time, when we meditated in the air-conditioned room, all the sloth and torpor disappeared. You had some very good and deep meditating. And that really taught me an important lesson, that sometimes the obstacles to your meditation are physical. So, you know, try and find a comfortable place. Try and find a soft cushion. You don't get anywhere in Buddhism by meditating on broken grass in the middle of the jungle being eaten by mosquitoes. Yeah, you're a tough guy, but you're not a wise guy. And here we are, wise guys and wise girls, to meditate. So make it comfortable, first of all. And of course, these days, many people meditate in chairs. So thank you, Bhante Santi, for actually sitting in a chair to encourage people. And the reason why Buddha got into such a deep state is, when he was a young kid, was because he wasn't striving. He was just letting go. And because that attitude of letting things be, not struggling or striving, things disappeared and vanished. This is the important part of meditation. First of all, for those of you who are new to meditation, too often people call meditation as concentration. For those of you who keep hearing me again and again and again, please excuse me for pushing this point, but it's an important one. When people have the misconception that meditation means concentrating your mind, you will never discover the peace, the bliss, the deep insights which meditation can give you. It was just an unfortunate translation of the early scholars who translated these Buddhist words into English. And the much more accurate translation for this word, samadhi, is stillness. And having taught that for many years, a disciple who's an MIT professor of business, who visited my monastery, she confirmed that she's knowledgeable of the scriptures, the same scriptures in Chinese, and the word for samadhi, for this meditative attainment of, you know, you're settling down, it never means concentration, but always means stillness. And once you understand that meditation is not about concentrating the mind, but stilling the mind, it's a game changer, as they say, because it's quite clear just to everybody, you don't still the mind by forcing it. And the basic simile of imagining a lake in the mountains, the idea of a body of water being a symbol of one's mind, is so ancient you find it, you know, in these books of ancient symbols. And imagine your mind like a lake of water. And the idea is not to concentrate that water, it's to keep it still, so that there are no waves, no, not even ripples on the surface of that water. And you know that the stillness in that lake is a natural state. It's only disturbed when there are winds or things fall into that lake, which create the ripples and the waves. But imagine that nothing fell into that lake and the wind was not blowing. After a while, that lake would return to its natural state of perfect stillness. And once the lake is still, without a ripple on its surface, it's called glassy smooth, and only then will it perfectly reflect the moon, the stars above it, and all the mountains surrounding it. It'll be like looking in a mirror, with no distortion of the truth. Which is why that when the mind is perfectly still, only then can it reflect this thing we call the Dhamma, to see things as they truly are. In Pali, Samadhi, Paccaya, Yatha, Bhuti, Anudassana, stillness is the cause for seeing things as they truly are. So stillness is the path on the goal. And the only way to be still is to stop interfering. It is the wind which creates the waves on the lake. And it is our wanting something which creates the disturbance in our mind. So the whole path becomes one of being able to sit down and by not wanting anything, just observing, letting the mind return to its natural state of stillness. It's such a difficult thing to want nothing, which is why letting go or letting things be is one of the hardest things a human being can do. And one of the reasons is because we are afraid. We are afraid of not planning for the future. We're afraid of just not remembering all of our past. We're afraid of not thinking, because it's weird when we're still, when nothing is happening. It's as if we are disappearing. Because to let go, the thing which interferes has to disappear. And that thing which interferes is you. You have to get out of the way to let meditation happen. And if you don't know that the monks and nuns will confirm, I'm quite a well-known meditation teacher. People have a lot of faith in me. But very often, as a monk, you always have to be 100% honest. And so I have confessed many times, I, Ajahn Brahm, cannot meditate. But Ajahn Brahm is a hopeless meditator. And I say that as a bit of a joke, because Ajahn Brahm has to get out of the way first of all. I have to disappear and let meditation happen. And then it goes incredibly deep. If I try and do it, then it's always being interfered with, and you find the meditation doesn't get anywhere. So somehow or another, you know, you have to learn how to vanish, to disappear. To be a silent observer, to be someone who can watch without interfering, not even to be a backseat driver, but just to be and let go. So in order to do that, what should be a very simple thing, and it's simple when you know how. In order to do that, you know, we have all these little techniques, stages if you like, of learning just how to disengage, you know, with our body and disengage from our mind. And as we do disengage, little by little we disappear, and so do the things which we temporarily own. And usually those stages of meditation are quite clear. They happen for everybody. No, basically. It's a well-worn path. And that's why we call them stages. But they're not stages you attain. It's one of my teacher, the great Ajahn Chah, one of his wonderful sayings was that you meditate not to attain things. You meditate to let go of things. So if you're meditating, try to get some place, somewhere, some achievement. You'll find, again, that's too much wanting. It will stir up your mind and you will never find any stillness. But when we learn how to let go of things, the mind becomes still all by itself. Because the very cause of disturbance is removed. So in order to let go, the first thing we let go of is time. We allow time to disappear. In order to let time disappear, you find out the perception of time is always a space between the past and the present, the past and the future, or the present and the future. It's a measuring. And if, and only if, we can let go of time, by which I mean let go of all past and all future, all conception of past and future, you find that time disappears, and with it, much sense of ownership. I was telling some people a week or two ago, my mother passed away about a year ago. She had dementia for about 2 or 3 years. And when I went to see her, she never recognized who I was. Even when I was the first person to go into that dementia ward in a brown robe, you'd think that would make it stand out. But no, she didn't know me from anyone. But when I went into that ward with my brother, who was visiting her very often, the first thing my brother said when he saw my mother, "That's not her dress that she was wearing." And then he laughed and told me that this is not the first time he'd found our mother wearing somebody else's clothing. Because they had no memory of the past. They had no sense of ownership. Which meant that they would go into other people's rooms. If they found a dress they liked, they would just wear it. How cute that was. And wouldn't that be wonderful in our world if we needed a trousers or a robe, and if we liked it, we just put it on without any sense of this is mine and ownership. And it brought to mind just how when we let go of the past and the future, we let go of a lot of possessions as well. We don't know it's ours, or rather mine. It's just that possessiveness does require a sense of time. And that's an interesting way of understanding how when we let go of past and future, much of our attachments can vanish automatically. Just like my mother. Any dress she liked, she just put it on. Someone was wearing hairdressers, she was wearing someone else's dresses. It was very helpful that it was the same gender ward. So we let go of time. But how does she let go of time? Again, it's the fear. So many people have problems with their past, and for me as a monk of many years, I just cannot figure out just the stupidity of people who have had a painful experience in their past and they keep remembering it. Why on earth, something so painful, can't you throw it away and let it go? And I've told a story to many of you before. If you have painful experiences and memories of the past, write it down on a piece of paper. The best piece of paper is what we call toilet paper. Write it down in brown ink to make the very clear insight connection that what you're remembering is shit. It belongs on toilet paper. And if you ever have used toilet paper, there's no one, not even people who work for Save the Earth, will keep toilet paper and reuse it. Many, many times. You use it once, and then what do you do with it? You don't put it in your pocket, because only one side is used. Immediately, you put it in the bowl, and you let it go. So it's a great little technique. Put it on a piece of toilet paper, in brown ink, write it all down, take it to the loo, read it again, just to reinforce it, and then put it where it belongs. The painful experiences of the past belong in the toilet, and then you do the letting go ceremony. Flush it away. And that's actually psychologically quite powerful. So if we can do that, we get this incredible freedom from the past. We don't need to keep talking about it. We don't want to do that because we're afraid of being free. You know the old saying, I've seen this many times because I've been in prison many times, talking to prisoners, see them when they get released. They're terrified, some prisoners, of getting out of jail. They get used to their suffering. And to many people, that fear of letting go of the past is precisely the same fear of a prisoner being released from a jail. They got used to their pain. And they don't want to let it go. So what we do is we just let it go for a short time. Day release, or rather meditation release from your past. Just check it out, see what it's like. The past will come back to you afterwards, but at least now, see what it's like to totally let it go. You cannot answer the questions of the past by thinking about them. You can't learn from the past. You just get imprisoned by the past. You can only learn, this is in Buddhism, all wisdom, all insight, all enlightenment, you can only learn from the present. Not even the future. Again, it's through fear that we keep planning everything for the future. We're so afraid that things will go wrong and we'll make an idiot of ourselves. Or that you'll upset other people. And please, you've all lived long enough now to realize that if you do plan for the future, things go wrong anyway. You still make an idiot of yourself. And if you do make an idiot of yourself and do something weird or strange, like at lunchtime today, I walked through, almost through the mesh door. You see, it works again. I'm creating happiness and laughter in you. What a wonderful thing it is when you make an idiot of yourself. You make so many people happy. So, don't worry about it. So when you plan, things go wrong. When you don't plan, they go wrong. Both ways. You know, things go wrong and strange things happen. Life is fun. So for me, realizing whether I plan or don't plan, things go wrong anyway. I prefer not to plan. Especially most of the time when you're meditating, I just let the future look after itself. Realizing that now is where the future is being made. This very moment is the only time I have to do anything for my future. And the very best I can do for my future is to be peaceful, to be still, to be kind in this very moment. And health, happiness, success will come. It's karma. You do right intention right now, and the future has to be good. So, I'm not afraid of the future because I know how to get the very best future by forgetting about it and putting all the attention in this present moment. And it's not that hard for people to get into the present moment. And what disappears, which is important for you to recognize, is time. You don't know how many minutes have gone past sometimes. And this whole prison of having to get somewhere in a certain time, the worry about the past, the whole conception of time is vanished. You've got all the time in the world, no matter how busy you are, if you can rest in this moment. And stillness. You're not rushing around in time. Through stillness, something has disappeared. In this case, time. Past and future as well. And imagine just how much freedom that is. Which is why just in that first level of stillness, you get enormous sense of happiness, relief. It's like you can rest and recover from the hurrying of life. I also tell people that wherever I go in the world, it's very rare to find a human being in today's world. all you ever find are human goings. There are very few human beings, people actually being here. Have you noticed that in your life, you're always going somewhere else, going on to the next task, going on to the next place, going on to the next project, always going on to something else, which is why I forgot how to meditate and just be here, and be still in the moment. And when you're still in this present moment, now that's the first stage of the mindfulness. And many of you have heard mindfulness so often, but this is one of my inventions, realizing that mindfulness was not enough, because I know many people have done mindfulness retreats, and they're just so hard, and they haven't got that softness which I recognize as essential in this place of Buddhism. So I always realized from years ago that what they were missing was kindness. So invented the word kindfulness. Mindfulness, the awareness together with kindness. And again, if you want to be still, you have to learn how to be kind. Once a person received a phone call. Can you come out for coffee this afternoon? They said, yeah, sure. They said, we're going to go to Gloria Jean's. Not Dome, not Starbucks, because I like Gloria Jean's. You're going to come there. And you are not going to drink a latte, you're going to drink a short black, is that? I don't know my coffee. You're going to drink a short black. And you're not going to have one of those muffins you keep liking, you're going to have a biscuit, because that's what I like. And you're not going to talk about your stupid Buddhism, we're going to talk about politics, because that's what I like to talk about. We're not going to sit in the veranda, I'm going to sit in the back, because that's where I like to sit. And we're going to be there for 1.5 hours, because that's how long I want to sit. Are you coming? And of course, if you ever receive a telephone call like that, you'll say, I have just remembered, I've got to see my mother-in-law this afternoon. Any excuse to get out from going to stay with such a control freak who tells you where you're going to eat, what you're going to drink, where you're going to sit, and what you're going to talk about, for how long. Would you like to spend time with such a person? Later on, they get a call from another friend. Hey, would I like to come out for a cup of coffee? He says, sorry, I've got to see my mother-in-law. Oh, but you know that coffee shop you kept telling me about, in the back of Sydney somewhere. Now, I was really interested in that, because you say that lattes are absolutely delicious. Yeah, I would love to try one. And you say those blueberry muffins are out of this world to die for. You know, I want to try it. You've always been talking about this Buddhism business. You know, I'm a Catholic, but you know, I'd like to know something about it. So, you know, are you free? If someone is like that, you say, oh, forget about the mother-in-law, I can see her next week. I'm coming. Because they're friendly and they're kind and they're interested in you. And you spend much more than 1.5 hours, you end up spending all afternoon and being late for everything else because you're enjoying yourself. Now you can understand why many people can't stay in the present moment or stay with anything, because they're control freaks. And your poor mind recognizes you. So not her again. Gee, I'm out of here. Any place I can escape to, so it doesn't hang out with you. So without the kindness, you'll find your mind will always run away, will wander somewhere, will fall asleep, any place it can escape from you, because you have not been kind. So when you add this kindness to mindfulness, so you're kind to this present moment, and you find with that kindness you hang out there in this moment. You don't go thinking about all sorts of things, you don't go back to the past or the future, you're actually here. Because you're kind to this moment. If you're kind to someone, they like staying with you. That is the secret for maintaining attention on anything. Not through force, not through willpower, that makes you too tight and too tense and eventually the person escapes from you. But through kindness. This beautiful compassion of a Buddha. So when you're kind in this present moment, you stay with it. then you can actually get very still and very relaxed, and again things start to disappear. And the fellow who brought me here from the airport, Prashant, he was telling me he was teaching his daughter how to meditate, 21 years of age. And the first time he taught how to meditate, she opened her eyes and screamed. What the heck's going on? He said, I was sitting here and I couldn't feel my body. And she was really, really scared. And, you know, Prashant, you know, he said, he actually played one of my talks where I described that experience. That's what's supposed to happen. Oh, really? I mean, it wasn't bad. It was just weird. This is actually what happens in meditation. When you stay in the present moment and you're still, you're relaxed, you know, the brain doesn't need to keep checking on your body. The body relaxes and it vanishes. Because there's something, a very clear psychological cause for stillness causing vanishing. And it came about, I first understood this as a young man when I went to a Zen monastery for meditation retreat in the north of England. There wasn't many places to go to meditate at all. I'd go to any tradition, no matter who they were. But that was one of these meditation retreats where the master used the stick. So if you nodded even the slightest, the master would come round behind you. Whack! Hit you on the back. I never got hit. I deserved to. I never got hit because I was never the most sleepy. The guy sitting next to me was more sleepy than I was and got hit first. And as soon as I heard that, all my sleep I was terrified. It sounded so bad. But the worst part of it was, oh, it's very nice, no, it's just listen to the Dhamma. The spider, listen to Dhamma. So, in that Zen tradition, you had to meditate with your eyes open, facing the wall. And I'd never done that before, I'd always meditate with my eyes closed, but, you know, you're always willing to learn anything new. So I'm sitting there, watching the wall, just a plain whitewashed wall, with my eyes open, and suddenly, after about 10 or 15 minutes, no joke, the wall vanished. It just wasn't there anymore. And that was weird. I thought, great, another weird experience. Now, I'm never of the nature to be afraid, you know, of strange things. So that's been my nature, always to be investigative, courageous, go and find out, see what's going to be like. And of course it's weird when you do that. No drugs, nothing involved, you weren't going crazy, it's just once there was a wall, now it's disappeared. You weren't seeing anything. And of course it's quite easy to understand that the brain is only wired to notice things which change. And if something stays still long enough, it disappears. You know, the sound of the traffic in Sydney, after a while you just can't hear it. Or the sound of a fan or an aircon, if we ever had one here, after a while you couldn't hear it because it stays exactly the same. The brain turns off, and that's what happened with seeing. Nothing was moving, so the brain turned off the sense of sight. The wall vanished. And that is just the way that meditation works. If you keep the body still long enough, you don't sneeze, or you don't itch, then you don't hear anything. If you take, you don't feel the body anymore. If people don't make any noise, or the noise is constant, you don't hear it anymore. It turns off. Those are two of the hardest senses to turn off, hearing and feeling. Smell and taste are pretty easy to turn off. As long as people don't fart you in the meditation, it's very easy because you don't actually, the sense of smell doesn't change. And that's why if anybody does have wind, please make sure you sit at the back, not in the middle, so there's no one behind you. So, now that's also the reason why we used to have incense in the time of the Buddha. So, anyway. So, constant smell, constant sound, constant feelings in the body. And after a while you expect this, the body actually disappears, it vanishes, which is brilliant. So that about your body, but my body's always itching or aching, something's wrong with it. This is so brilliant to be able just to sit here and your body disappears. Whenever that happens to you, it's part of the course, it's supposed to happen. Don't interfere with it, don't get upset, because it's so peaceful and wonderful. When Chanda was saying, should we wear some mosquito repellent? There's not many mosquitoes over here, but looking at that video, I'm sure Venerable Satyakita will confirm this. There's so many mosquitoes in Thailand, and they were voracious. Especially in this monastery we just saw on the video, Wat Nana Chart in Thailand, where many of us train. That was a jungle monastery in those days. And there were so many mosquitoes there. And remember, these were the first white people who had gone to that part of Thailand. It was the first time the mosquitoes had Western food. And I'm sure they all took some and told their mates, hey guys, Western food in this monastery. And not only that, you know, the mosquitoes in Thailand have been genetically learned that if you see a brown robe, it's a safe meal. So they took advantage of our compassion and precepts. And this is no exaggeration. With one of my friends, now not one of the monks we saw in that video, another monk, we used to count mosquitoes on our arm when we used to meditate there in the jungle. We used to get about 70 or 80 at one time. And you couldn't count them anymore because they're literally too close together. And there's a lot. And of course you felt like running away. But the only way you cope with that was actually to sit down. Just go inside until your body vanished. You couldn't feel it anymore. And you had to do that, otherwise it was just far too irritating. So I used to thank the mosquitoes for making sure that I couldn't be heedless. If my mind wandered a bit, it would go back to my arm and just this really irritating sensations. So you go deep inside till the body vanished. You couldn't feel it anymore. And then you were just so sweet and fine. This is what's supposed to happen in meditation. But body disappears because you're still, nothing is moving. But then something still is moving. You're breathing. Which is why the breath meditation is not just something which a person chooses to do. It's just what happens when you start letting go. It's the last thing in your body which is still moving. So just observe your breath, because that's the only thing left to observe. And I teach many people, when they do breath meditation, that's the best way to do breath meditation, if you can be patient enough and follow the instructions to let go long enough so the body disappears. Because then when the breath comes up, it's so delightful. It's nice and peaceful already. But if you go looking for the breath at the beginning, you tend to control it, grab it, and it's never comfortable if you decide to watch it. Let it come to you, and it's very, very comfortable. So you're just watching the breath just with kindness in this present moment. You're just so still. Remember, that's what we were aiming for, stillness. Not concentration, but stillness. Let the disturbances vanish until all that's left is just your breathing. What happens, because you're very calm and still, your body doesn't need much oxygen. You don't need to metabolize so much, because you're relaxing, you're calming down. Your breath gets slower and more calm, more peaceful, until it becomes so even. An in-breath, an out-breath, you can hardly tell the difference between them. And because of that, because there is hardly any difference, the breath vanishes. And with that, the last of the five senses disappears. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. Your body is gone. And you go into this beautiful world of the mind. It's just through stillness, this thing called the five sense world, which is incredibly irritating, has vanished and you're free. I'm saying this because please don't be afraid when this happens to you. Don't think, ah, where's my breath gone? I'm going to die. You don't die. I've been teaching meditation for many years, Bhante Sanyatita's teach many years. Have you had any casualties yet? Anyone died on your meditation classes? Bhante?
What?
Have you had anyone die on your meditation classes?
No.
No, me too, neither. So you've got a perfect record. You are 100% safe. Don't think you're going to be the first person to spoil the record. You're perfectly safe. So when those things happen, don't be afraid. Because as soon as any fear comes up in meditation, then you start to control. We all know the connection between fear and control. That's what governments always use. You know, fear to try and control the population. That's what other people use on you to try and control you. Let go of all that fear. And it's very easy to let it go when you have no conception of the future. This very thing, little thing to fear. When you start thinking about what might happen next, that's when fear arises. So the quick antidote to fear is just let go of the future. And be confident if you're making peace, being kind, being gentle in this very moment. You've got nothing to be afraid of. 100% good karma. So then you stay there. And then you'll find you're meditating here and the body disappears. And you see this flash of light. It could be the photographer. But it's more than likely to be this thing we call this little limiter. It's what you see when the five senses vanish. And everybody will see that limiter sooner or later, if not during meditation, when you die. Have you seen those videos on YouTube of people who died on the operating table, or died in the car crashes, or had heart attacks? Floating out of their body and then going towards the light. That's exactly what you see when you meditate. So meditation can be called just death 101. Preparing how to die. Practicing before it really happens so you know what to expect. Your body and the five senses vanishing. And then what's left is this beautiful thing you call the mind. The sixth sense. And this is actually when you have experience of these things. So you get this stillness, things vanish, all these obstacles, and then you can actually come face to face with the thing which you call your mind. It's like seeing it in a mirror. And this is what we do, just allow that thing to be very, very still. And as it gets more and more still, the next thing which disappears. And this is where it gets deep. This is for the nuns. This is where your will starts to vanish. This thing which you thought belonged to you. Many people come to spiritual places like this with the idea that in order to live a happier, more meaningful life with less problems, what we should do is try and train our will to be smart, to empower our sense of choice with wisdom, so we can make wise choices instead of the stupid choices which has caused us so much trouble and problems in the past. But that is not the way. That's not what you're going to learn. You'll find that it's not trying to make your will smart. The will is always dumb. It's to let the will go and vanish. All choices are dumb. So the will actually vanishes. Which means you're not doing anything anymore. You're not interfering. You're not making that lake have waves. You're not disturbing anything anymore. That thing called will disappears. Wow. And then you bliss out. Big time. I always buy anecdotes to give you some understanding. The anecdote which I used to give was that one of the reasons why I became a monk, why many people become monks or nuns, because you have these experiences. When the first time I got a deep meditation, I was still a lay person, having a girlfriend, and I had sex with her just about 10 days before I started the retreat. Less actually. So, you know, I was sexually active, and then went on a retreat, got into a state of meditation, and he came out afterwards, and it was very, very clear, this is much better than sex with your girlfriend. We had good sex. It's better than orgasm. Lasts longer, more pleasurable, and no danger with babies. My first thought was, why hasn't anyone told me about this before? Why are they keeping this a secret? This is brilliant. Recently, about a year ago, we had this guy come to stay in Bodhidharma Monastery who was a recovering heroin addict. Really trying hard to give up this incredible addiction. And he was doing well, but you know, eventually he left and went back again. You have so much sympathy for people. It's an incredible battle, and it's just so hard to win. You know, it takes days and days and days and days of saying no, but only one second of saying yes, and you're back where you started. It's an incredible fight. But you know, he was really doing well. But I remember him running up the path to me one day. He said, "Ajahn Brahmacharya, I've got to talk to you." He said, "You know, I heard you say that, you know, this is better than sex, but I never thought it would be better than heroin." He said it was incredible. So you know, he just had a taste. Because apparently, you know, heroin is much better than sex. You know, I know the sex bit years ago, but heroin I never had. But you know, it's incredible bliss. Now, are you interested? Whenever you teach anything, you always have to have some marketing. This is the market, get people interested. Yeah, okay, I'm into this. But it's also you have to let go of things. And this is what happens when this sense of will disappears. You get very blissed out, so incredibly still and peaceful, because there's nothing to disturb you anymore. And it's not that you did it. You didn't do it. It was the doing which stopped you getting into these states. So straight away, you know, you understand this thing called choice was a big obstacle. And will. And anyway, is it really you who's choosing to do things? Is anyone into marketing here, into the advertising industry? I know that I've read many reports that for every dollar you spend in advertising, you can get $3 back. Average. Which is why that so many people want to advertise. They can't find enough places to advertise on. Which is why Google and Twitter, you know, open to advertising, because that's where the money is, and advertising increases your sales. Why? Does it affect you when you see the adverts on the roads going back to Sydney? Does it affect you when you read the magazines and see those photos and pictures? Does it affect you when you watch the TV? Most ads are so stupid that no one would believe in those stupid ads you see on TV. That is a great trick to lull you into a sense of superiority that's not affecting you. If they make the ads smart, people might suss out what they're doing to you. Making them, dumbing the ads down, make you believe that they're not affecting you. But my goodness, they are. And don't think that you're special. We succumb. We are manipulated. Manipulated by our culture, by our government, by the TV, into a much greater way than you ever imagined. This is the nature of will, totally conditioned and influenced by others. So when I give talks like this, I openly admit that I am brainwashing you. I am changing your will, but in a beautiful way to free you. And this is why you can't do it by yourself. You just need like people like Sangha to put those seeds into you, to basically to brainwash you, to advertise, to change the way that you look long enough for you to see for yourself. Now, I know that Chandra asked me, can you do a deep talk? It always reminds me of once going to Singapore. I've been going to Singapore for years and years. And always giving talks about two bad bricks. Open the door of your heart. Be kind, be compassionate. Always wonderful talks which people really got off on. But one day, this lawyer said, can I have a deep talk today? Just like you give the monks. So I gave him a talk on the nature of will. The following morning, when he picked me up for breakfast, don't ever do that to me again. I was so terrified, I never slept all night. So it is terrifying to think you're not in charge. It challenges you. I don't know if any of you have ever seen the work of Professor Libet, L-I-B-E-T. He was one of these neuroscientists. Had a very simple experiment. You know, all you do, the victims or the experimenters, will just flex the hand up and down like this. But when you decide to flex your hand, you press a little button to say that now you're going to do it. And it's very simple to actually, to, you know, for the action time, to work out, you know, that the time that they decided, or they were aware of making a decision, now I'm going to flex my hand, to actually see that time. But they also had a gizmo on the brain to find out when the brain decided, what they called a readiness potential, which appears in some part of the brain. And his discovery was, the readiness potential appears first, in about 0.7 of a second. And then afterwards you decide. And then you move. In other words, that what you recognize as a conscious decision is already too late. The whole process has already begun. The thing which you recognize and identify as your will is not the originator of any process. The process has already begun. It's part of the process. You've associated so many times that thing which you recognize, you think, you can see sometimes as will. You've associated that with the action so much you think that's the cause. It's not the cause. By the time that you make a conscious decision, it's already too late. It has to happen. That's science confirming what meditators know. And that's scary when you realize you are out of control. You are being manipulated by the nuns of Santi Monastery. It's a good manipulation. So what happens then? The sense of doing has disappeared. And it's really bliss. That's the nice thing about it. That you feel that this will business, this doing, it's not just an illusion, but it's a prison. It's like you're in a prison cell, and the door is always open, and the prisoner's got five walls around it called seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, the five senses. And you've got this prison guard who will never let you sit still, and his name is Will. Always making you do something and move. It's so hard to sit there and do nothing. Why? This will gets involved all the time. You've got to trick it to be still. And when you do trick it to be still, not only are the five walls of the prison, but the prison guard is no longer there. You can walk out and come and go. You're free. And that's what it feels like in these deep states of meditation. Freedom, bliss at last. I don't know if you ever, any of you read the book or saw the video of that Indian lady who described an out-of-body experience, Muni or Moni, something or other. But she described an out-of-body experience, going towards this incredible light and going into the light. And experiences 100% perfect love, incredible bliss, of being single with the whole universe. And just feelings were so accepted and so at peace. And some people thought, ah, that must be union with God or heaven at last. That is what you experience in the deep meditations. And what I was so fascinated with was how people experience the purest, the highest of ultimate love with the bliss of the deep meditations. Now, you basically disappeared. The sense of love, acceptance, perfection, nothing wrong. Have you ever had that love from someone who just, you know, you can be. You don't have to strive anymore. You don't have to fulfill anybody's expectations or try and be better. You're at last. You're still. And that love and that bliss, they actually come together. It's exactly the same state, just the way people describe it, that's all. And that's what you actually feel when you let go. The will has vanished, and you bliss out big time. You want to know the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering. You realize this thing called will and choice is suffering, which is why, you know, we teach the way of meditation to let go. Not to exert the will. If you exert the will at the very beginning, you're just encouraging it. It's not the path. You've got to free the will. Be still, be peaceful. And you also understand why people who do have strong wills, achieve a lot in this world, have got these big egos. And they always get angry and they control others. That's never the way of Buddhism. The Buddha was not a control freak. Incredibly kind. Letting people go, letting people be. So that, you know, the path, the goal of stillness, you can see how they come together. So you let go and the will vanishes. And the last little simile at this particular stage is, alright, you've got to be hard to create similes. This is one which I created, which is very accurate and very meaningful. The simile that of the tadpole and the frog. The tadpole lives all his life in water. Born in water, goes to school in water, even in the water of the little Buddhist temple which he goes to. And it learns, you know, at school about in chemistry that water is H2O. It learns from Buddhist school that water is one of the four elements. And it learns all about these things, but do you think a tadpole can ever understand what water is? Can't, because it's born in water, lived all its life in water. It may think it knows, but it can't. No more than a fish can know what water is. But the difference between a fish and a tadpole is a tadpole one day becomes a frog. And when it becomes a frog, one day it doesn't really know what it's doing. It jumps out of the water and sits on dry land. And for a frog, for the first time, imagine how weird that is. Never experienced anything like that ever before. Dry land. And the reason it's weird is because something which has always been there is now gone. It's vanished. It's disappeared. Water. Only now the frog, once before a tadpole, now a frog, only now can understand what water is. Once it has disappeared. Same with will. The only time we can understand what will is when it vanishes. Yeah, sometimes you don't exert your will, but it's always there. You always got the mouse ready to click, the lever ready to pull. Imagine there's no mouse to click, there's no levers, there's no controls at all. The will is way beyond you, it's vanished, it's disappeared. Only then do you understand what craving is. Cause of suffering. When it vanishes, blissing out. Only when you're still to that degree, there's nothing to cause any movement. The wind has gone, vanished. Only then can your mind perfectly reflect the beautiful forests, the trees, the mountain peaks, and the moon and stars above it. Only through stillness. Perfect stillness. Can you understand the truth of things? Da da da. You satisfied? No, impossible. Nothing's creepy. So that's the art of disappearing. Poof, when you're gone. Sadhu. What did you do that for? Because you're supposed to do it. No. Totally conditioned. Brainwashed by our culture. So, any questions? Comments, complaints? Yes, thank you, Josh.
There was a documentary recently on the brain and consciousness, and they asked three of the world's top neuroscientists how much of consciousness is conscious. And they also put a great question, And they all gave the same answer, which was basically about less than 5% of what we do is done by conscious wills. Most of it's all controlled by the unconscious.
Yes. Well, that's the maximum figure.
Mm.
How much of the consciousness is controlled by the will?
Mm.
Consciously. So a lot of times, don't believe those neuroscientists. They don't know what they're talking about. Totally crazy people.
Well, they were saying that.
They
had great experiments where people thought they were consciously choosing things.
Oh, yeah.
And they could show that they actually was all unconsciously done.
Exactly. So with them, they had no choice but to say that because they're conditioning as neuroscientists.
Mm.
It appears that we're doing this.
Mm.
That really, sort of really starts to... And don't go thinking and just getting yourself into rational knots about this, because you can't understand what the will is until you get into the deep jhanas. This is the thing, it just blows your head off. You know, you think that you knew, but now you're a tadpole. Which is one of the reasons why we have to meditate to get some insight, isn't it?
So it's the same will that... is it our will then that maybe motivates us towards trying to end that stuff?
Yes, it's the realization of suffering, which is the motivation to happiness, and the highest happiness is when the will vanishes. It's pursuit of happiness. Sometimes say the pursuit of truth, which is another form of happiness, but that is what drives us forward. Sorry, does that make sense?
Not quite following it.
Pursuit of happiness. Look,
yeah.
Many people, they come here because they want a happier life.
Yeah.
They want to get rid of their problems, their psychosis, their depression, whatever else it is, lack of success in life, whatever. You come to Buddhist monasteries because it promises happiness, and it works. I mean, so many studies have shown you meditate, you're more successful, less diseases, pretty your immune system, blah, 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 you live a happier life. So people come to Buddhism for the sake of happiness. But then, you know, you get these monks like me to say the highest happiness. Oh, better with sex anyway, it's deep meditation. People go for it. And they do realise that people that get in meditation, the happier they are. Look, there's one of the retreats I gave last year, a lady in Sydney, when she got back here, she wrote a letter. She had to beg her boss for 9 days off, literally no grovel for them, you know what it's like. And when she got back, her boss told her, she wrote this in her letter to me, the boss said, "What have they been giving you in Perth? Whatever it is, can you please bring back some for me next time?" Thinking it was some sort of ecstasy or ice or something which, you know, they're feeding her, because she was incredibly happy afterwards. So you can see this is what happens. So that happiness drives you forward. It's much more so than the pursuit of truth. People think they're pursuing truth, but only for the sake of usually happiness. And people go deeper and deeper into it. And it's the happiness and its power which actually stops your fear and overcomes it. It's just having too good a time to be afraid. So you had a question there.
So I was just going to ask regarding what you were saying about time.
Oh, yeah.
Stopping time.
Yeah.
Living in the modern world where everything's happening so fast and being able to actually just stop and be present and stop past and future, it seems a bit of a paradox, because you have to stop time to be able to be in the moment.
Yeah.
But you can't operate outside of time to practically live your life.
You can do that, you can take moments off. This is, if you haven't seen this, many people have seen this before. I get bored of saying this because I've seen it more times than anybody. How heavy is my glass of water? The longer I hold it, the heavier it feels. After 1 minute, my arm aches. 2 minutes, I'm in pain. 3 minutes, I'm in absolute agony and a very stupid muck. What should I do when it starts to get too uncomfortable to continue holding? You just put it down for 30 seconds or a minute. That's all you need. And afterwards, after 30 seconds, if you try this yourself, you pick it up afterwards, it actually does feel lighter. It's It's only because your arm's rested, that's all. And that's the secret to overcoming any stress. Stress has nothing to do with how much water's in your cup, how many responsibilities and duties you have in your life. Everything to do is when it gets too uncomfortable to keep going on, putting it down and resting. Because if you just give yourself a few minutes in the present moment, just being here, not worrying about what you have to do in the afternoon, then you find you relax. And the brilliant thing about that is, because you relax after you've done that in the afternoon, your brain is far more efficient. You get, you know, 3 hours done in, or hours work done in 2 hours of high quality. And I started teaching, I've been teaching this for years, but I gave a keynote at the World Computer Conference in Brisbane. Even though I don't know anything about computers, but that doesn't stop me. If there's any weird conference like that, you know, I gave the keynote at the World Computer Conference a couple of years ago in Brisbane. You know just how I know about computers. I've been on the computer down here and always asking, "Simon, please help me, please help me." Like I asked Shelley this afternoon, because I got stuck. And I gave a keynote to all these big shots from Microsoft and stuff. And I gave this similarly here. I had to do with stress. And from there it went into the Australian newspaper, the IT section. And then it went on to the Australian Stock Exchange site. And from there it migrated to Harvard Business School blog. And I called it an investment for the afternoon. Okay, you know, you've just got to put it in the right language. Because it's an investment. You give yourself half an hour of break time and you make it up in the afternoon with greater efficiency and higher quality work. It's really such a no-brainer. I don't see why more companies don't do that. You get much more productivity. Because you all know, if you're really tired, you know, you're wasting time trying to push the brain to make decisions or write some reports. But if you just only rest for half an hour, afterwards, your brain is clear, you know, it can be inventive, words come to you so quickly instead of struggling. You do much more in less time, higher quality. It's investment. So that's why we can stay in the present moment and we find we can succeed much more in life, get more done. Relax, rest. But to do that, you have to practice. Yes?
Okay. I can't relate to speaking after happiness anymore.
Uh-huh.
Because it said your state is transient.
Ah, it's transient. But to get rid of all transiences, we always tend to go to a deeper sense of happiness. There are many levels of happiness. So the ordinary happiness, you know, you've seen is transient. So you let that go, so you're no longer in the control of this transient happiness and suffering. So I'm just going to let all that go. Why? Because it's less suffering for you. It's another level of happiness.
I prefer to call it peace.
Great.
It's more meaningful.
Great. Peace is the highest happiness. So it's very true. But you go to these incredible different levels of even peace. It's one of the great things with meditation. You think things can't be more peaceful. But then you go to a deeper sense of peace. I don't know if there's any mathematicians here, but one thing I loved about pure mathematics was to learn that there is a number infinitely bigger than infinity. The infinity is not the biggest number in the world. They call it in mathematics alpha null, the infinity which most people know. The number which is infinitely bigger than infinity is called alpha one, and it keeps going to infinity and beyond. And it's just blowing your mind, bending it. You know, and this is really sort of strong, incontrovertible proof. A number which is infinitely bigger than infinity. A peace which is deeper than the deepest peace. And that's the great thing about the path of meditation, a happiness which is more happy than these transient happinesses. A bliss which is bigger than bliss. That's why it gets a very wonderful journey. So it's a great question. That's why they always used to say that Nibbana, Nibbana Paramang Sukham, Nibbana is the highest happiness. It's the ultimate. But how can it be happiness when there's nothing to be experienced there? It's just... Go on.
I reflected on that, sorry to interrupt, but if you go back to the Pali tense, dukkha is too difficult to bear, sukha easy to bear, then if we see Nibbana Paramang Sukham, sure, of course, that's true.
It's more than difficult to bear or easy to bear.
It's the easiest to bear. Of course it is, because it's free from defilement, free from burden. So naturally that is true.
There's no one to bear anything in these deep meditations. There's no bearing anything at all. It's everything is disappearing. So all burdens, everything which is born, is vanishing, simply because there's nobody there to hold anything anymore. Total vanishing of things. But I must admit that I do take issue with that translation, because there's sometimes that if we try and analyze a word by splitting into parts, it's like the word together. What does the word together in English mean? If you split into parts, it means to get her. So this is why analysis of words in any language is fraught with trouble, which is why the only way we understand the meaning of words, in fact, I remember this Professor Water, he wrote this, and it really meant a lot to me in the study of language. He says, a word has no meaning, only a phrase has a meaning, and the word is totally subject to the other words which surround it. The unit of language is never the word, but the sentence or the phrase. And because sukha has no meaning apart from the words surrounding it. And one of our problems in life is we focus on the words rather than the phrases. So in the context, you can't really separate sukha from nibbana paramang sukha. The phrase has the meaning, not the individual word.
Nibbana is the ending of dukkha. There's no one there. No one to come, no one to go. Nothing to bear, nothing to look for. When you be still, stillness begins to speak of the sound of silence. The sound of silence reveals a light of being, and being shows the presence of uncontaminated, pure, timeless, deathless being. So you have a sequential order. You disappear. And he asks me the question whether I ever saw one in meditation to die. No, not literally. Physically, but my teacher taught me die before dying, and I only saw that relevant in meditation. Without meditation, you can't perceive that, because you'd be in a sequential movement of time, but in the stillness, in the silence, in pure being, you'll be uncontaminated presence and a boundless life and energy and process, which has no wavering. It's so succinctly, pointedly still that it embraces boundlessly everything without any trace. Like there is in the Dhammapada a quote, freedom is like a bird in the sky, leaving no traces. Now when you go through the meditation, as you explain, the stillness. Stillness speaks of clarity of the sound of silence, which reveals the light and power of being present in an uncontaminated, boundless being. And that is true life. The life and time is only dominantly unconsciously contaminated by things outside, not by clear consciousness. We have that clear consciousness in us. The nature of our mind, the original mind, is pure, bright, and luminous, and timeless. And remember, I whispered in your ear, the heart of the Buddha is first of all timeless, unconditioned, and deathless. These are the beatings of the heart of the Buddha. The way to Nibbana is what he describes, but Nibbana itself, you have to see the three things. So observing the nature of things, which is impermanent, suffering, and anatta. You observe this very clearly, then gradually it reveals the silence, it gives you the timeless being and freedom of bearing the dukkha of our existential embodiment. Because your body is not the body which you think to have. That's thinking, and that's built by things outside. And then that has separated. The body which you are is made of elements which are universal. They are not having any boundaries of element without boundaries. They're just elements. And when you understand that, then that reveals itself the nature of the universe. So.
Dante, how can you explain when the Buddha said that all being is suffering? And Nibbana is the end of all being, Bhava Nirodha.
Well, existentially, yes, it is.
Yeah.
All beings,
life
itself is not suffering. Life becomes suffering by not having the wisdom to see the Dharma. It's important. So, all being, not seeing the Dharma, having the wisdom to see the Dharma, of course suffer and continue the pain of suffering, but it's naturally produced, it's not naturally generated, it's not inherently manifested. It is fabricated by the mental process. So the suffering is an existential condition, but in the light of being, also in the presence of Nibbana, there's no suffering, and no one to bear, or no one to deny. There is just the gift and the blessings, as I say, of boundless being. Life itself has no comparison. Being itself is boundless. Be open and peaceful.
What?
When people understand the Dharma, then there is no suffering. Physically, exceptionally, because being also like a conditioned body, yes, there is suffering, and we fabricate that more from things outside, from things fragmented and perpetuated. But without that, when you die in meditation, when you disappear, when absence reveals itself in the nature of life, there cannot be time or being, because that is existential. It's not the nature of living. I will answer that way. The wisdom of the Dharma leads you to beyond suffering, leads you to Nibbana. And there you find what beats in the heart of the Buddha. It's important to practice and follow his path is what he's taught, which is very, very simple but very profound. But when you go into it and you see gradually a light of a vision of an unbounded vision which abides, begins to abide in the non-abiding.
Are you saying, Bente, the original mind is outside of the five khandhas?
What?
Are you saying the original mind, this boundless being, is
yes.
outside of the five khandhas?
Yes. I'm saying the original mind is light, nature and truth. The original light, that mind, the Buddha say, is pure, bright and luminous.
So
contaminated by defilements from outside.
So the Buddha never said original mind.
He said, really, that,
you cannot really look at the Buddha's suttas and even say a thing called original mind. That particular quote is
not say that
yes.
is maybe later
yeah.
expression of it. But he say in Anicutta Vikaya, the mind's nature is maybe pure light and luminous.
It's radiant when it hasn't got the five hindrances.
What?
He says it's radiant, it's prabhasava when it's free of the five hindrances,
yes.
of Pachinivarana.
Yes.
And that is the state of the nimitta mind.
Yeah. That is.
That's where it's limited. It's not nirvana,
the
jhana mind.
Then it enters the boundless time.
Excuse me. Isn't there another word for the grounded existence?
Not in Pali.
Not in
No.
Not that I know in Pali, no. Existence on the ground of being, it's like a different vision, different energy. The ground of being is like this relevant life, truth and nature. There's the ground of the existence is always contaminated. It's always perpetuating.
Isn't the mind one of the five khandhas, and aren't all the five khandhas subject to suffering and conditioned?
Indeed.
And there's nothing beyond that at all.
The Buddha often said that this mind will be destroyed. This is the Arhats speaking.
Remember, he called this upadana khandha. The upadana in the khandha. Not the khandha itself, that's also like part of life. But the upadana in the khandha is that what contaminates.
I understood that upadana khandha means the five khandhas that we get attached to, not attachment to the five khandhas, because the Buddha in the Anattalakkhana Sutta said that the five khandhas are subject to suffering, impermanent and non-self.
Yes.
So not only attachment to the five khandhas is suffering, but the five khandhas are suffering.
Yes.
Themselves.
That is correct.
Even without attachment. So, even an arahat
would suffer. Yes, because you know the reference also. Buddha teaches that the upadana khandha, the attachment to the khandhas, they then become contaminated. Because the Buddha reached sa-upadise-sa-nibbana and pari-nibbana. Because of sa-upadise-sa-nibbana, like nibbana with the five khandhas still present. And nibbana with the five khandhas still present, but not attached to. Therefore, we put them later in the pari nibbana.
But there's no mind.
Pari nibbana is anupadisesa.
What?
The pari nibbana
is anu.
That means absolutely nothing remaining.
Yeah. No return and no perpetuation. It means that anupadisesa.
Yeah, total God. Nothing left.
No being.
That's why one of the great sayings of the Buddha, Bante, was when he had a bit of shit on his finger, and he said, even a small bit of feces on a finger stinks.
Yeah.
Even a small bit of being stinks.
Yeah. Even small things contaminates.
And I think it's the is it that Tibetan position whereby they say, since the ultimate reality is there is no self and all is emptiness,
yeah,
you don't need to do anything. Because you know, you're just mucking around with what's not there.
But one can believe that superficially if one never practices that. If that was really the case, there's emptiness, there's nothing there, then no Tibetan would ever become a monk.
Yeah.
They would, wouldn't even eat. They wouldn't even go to the toilet. What's the point of going to the toilet? There's nothing there. So those things are when people have great ideas. But that's all it is, just intellectual stuff.
Mm.
And their practice, what they do, doesn't actually match anywhere close to that. There's a great story of the Zen monk who was begging for alms. He was really hungry, and when someone said that there's a restaurant down there, the owner's a Buddhist, and he said, "Great, I will go and get some food." So he went to see this owner, and the owner said, "Well, just to prove that you are a real Buddhist monk, teach me some Dhamma." And the monk said, "Form is emptiness, emptiness is form." And she said, "Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu, sit down, I'll get you a meal." And so he was salivating, thinking of the great food he was going to get, and she came with one of these dishes, you know, with the cover on. So when she opened the cover, there was nothing there. If form is emptiness and emptiness is form, eat emptiness, muck.
Is it correct to think that emptiness is not really in the right translation anyway? Isn't it empty rather than emptiness?
In fact, that's really empty of stuff.
Yeah.
Empty is contingent on what's empty of.
Right. Because I've heard also people saying, well, if form is emptiness, then emptiness can be form. In other words, there can be something left. But it's not emptiness.
Yes,
it's the thing, isn't it? It's empty of something.
Empty of something.
Form is empty. Yes. It's empty.
In other words,
form.
There's nothing essential there. It's just conditioned.
That's the Heart Sutra, isn't it?
It is the Heart Sutra, yeah. But it's actually, again, it's a very good point. Because emptiness... it's empty of what? So you know, this is, again, use of language to get you to a point of confusion.
Central.
I think it'd be empty,
yeah. I think we put it. And that's all it has to, original mind is a later interpretation.
Indeed.
Anyway, I'm quite aware to put a simply for reminding
me.
Freedom from the five hindrances then reveals the mind in purity and luminosity.
So, there is a difference between consciousness and mind. What I'm aware is that it's not the consciousness in the body, but actually what I see is the body and mana in the consciousness. See what I mean? The consciousness is boundless, and what arises within is just aggregate.
The consciousness is not boundless, it's contingent, it's caused.
Yeah.
It arises from causes and conditions.
But when we see this, we see the individual consciousness just moving,
then
and there is this state of awareness that it's just there.
There's six types of consciousness, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and knowing consciousness. And the delusion is caused, very similar to those old flipping off cartoons which gave the illusion of movement and continuity. There were separate little cards, or like the old silent movies, one frame after another running so fast, it gave the illusion of continuity.
Yes.
In the same way, there are six different types of consciousness that are totally different from one another. And because mind consciousness follows the other consciousnesses, when you see, you know that you saw. When you hear, you know that you heard. When you know that you knew. And that flipping of cards gives the illusion of continuity in the same way that the speed of the conscious process and the fact that the mind consciousness comes after every other consciousness gives the illusion of a continuity. Just like the grains of sand on a beach, built at a distance, you think it's a continuous. You look closer, you find as individual grains with nothing connecting them. And when that is seen, there's no consciousness which is continuous, which goes from one moment of experience to another. Individual moments, which means there's nothing permanent, there's no ground consciousness, there's no ultimate consciousness. This is a phenomena which is caused when the causes disappear, even consciousness ceases, without remainder. All consciousness, you say they're not a lack of a sister, gross, refined, far and near, cosmic, worldly, all consciousness ceases.
And finally, example of this also, that people are brain dead and not conscious. They still come back. How could they come back if there's no continuum of consciousness? Because there's only one conscious state at the time of being. So how can they come back when there is no conscious of brain movement? So we are then more than our consciousness. Consciousness gives the illusion of the continuity and we follow up. But when we are in being, then that's a different energy of life altogether.
Are you all happy to carry on, or shall we go to bed?
I don't know how to put it into words actually, but if there is a sense of being empty and beyond awareness of sight, sound, taste, touch, smell, hearing, everything ceases, why do you call that bliss? How can an experience be described as elevated if it's all gone?
Okay.
No,
how this was the question which was asked of Sariputta. He gave a very brilliant answer. He said, when a person is sick, when the sickness has vanished, they feel the happiness of the return to health. He said, when the five senses vanish, they're a burden. And that is the cause of the bliss of, say, the first jhana, the absence of the five hindrances. And he said, when the last little movement of the mind, which is a separation between the first and the second jhana, as the second jhana is referring to when will disappears, consciousness is still there, the second jhana. But then, you know, that bliss starts to vanish into stages, first of all, the piti and then the sukha, until you get this beautiful equanimity of the fourth jhana. But even though it's supposed to be no happiness there, but in another place call it the happiness of equanimity. When something has vanished, you feel a sense of freedom and happiness. And he said, this particular way of looking at it serves the nirvana when everything has stopped. I mean, including all happiness and suffering. And that's the only place where it does stop, you know, in the cessation of all consciousness, of all mind, of all sensations. That is called the highest bliss. You know, similar to what Dharma is saying, no more happiness, no more suffering, no more anything. Because whenever this mind, whenever this consciousness, you have to be conscious of something. And that has to change. If it's still, it vanishes. And whatever this movement, anicca, is always going to be some things are better than others. You have sukha and dukkha again. Happiness and suffering. Night and day.
Don't try to put it into thinking. Mm. It's unthinkable.
Mm.
It breaks. When you try to do this, it breaks up your mind. But it's right experience.
But Pantesh, if I leave the Araham?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Arahaṁ Sammā Sambuddho Bhagavā Buddhaṁ Bhagavanta Abhivādhemi Suvākato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammānamassāmi Satipatthipanno Bhagavato Sāvaka Saṅgho.